corpses. Rooster said, "They would have taken them other two as well and exchanged them later. They'd done it before."
"Then what would Moon and Quincy do for mounts?"
"They'd have the 6 tired horses."
"Oh, I had forgotten about them."
"It was only a swap for a few days."
"I was thinking that Lucky Ned Pepper might have been planning to murder the 2 stock thieves. It would have been a treacherous scheme, but then they could not inform against him. What do you think?"
"No, Ned would not do that."
"Why not? He and his desperate band killed a fireman and an express clerk on the Katy Flyer last night."
"Ned does not go around killing people if he has no good reason. If he has a good reason, he kills them."
"You can think what you want to," said I. "I think betrayal was part of his scheme." We reached J.J. McAllister's store about 10 o'clock that morning. The people of the settlement turned out to see the dead bodies, and there were gasps and murmurs over the spectacle of horror, made the worse by way of the winter morning being so sunny and cheerful. It must have been a trading day, for there were several wagons and horses tied up about the store. The railroad tracks ran behind it. There was little more to the place than the store building, and a few smaller frame and log structures of poor description. And yet, if I am not mistaken, this was at that time one of the best towns in the Choctaw Nation. The store is now part of the modern little city of McAllister, Oklahoma, where for a long time coal was king. McAllister is also the international headquarters of the Order of the Rainbow for Girls. There was no real doctor there at that time, but there was a young Indian who had some medical training and was competent to set broken bones and dress gunshot wounds. LaBeef sought him out for treatment. I went with Rooster, who searched out an Indian policeman of his acquaintance, a Captain Boots Finch of the Choctaw Light Horse. These police handled Indian crimes only, and where white men were involved, the Light Horse had no authority. We found the captain in a small log house. He was sitting on a box by a stove getting his hair cut. He was a slender man, about of an age with Rooster. He and the Indian barber were ignorant of the stir our arrival had caused. Rooster came up behind the captain and goosed him in the ribs with both hands and said,
"How is the people's health, Boots?"
The captain gave a start and reached for his pistol, and then he saw who it was. He said,
"Well, I declare, Rooster, what brings you to town so early?" "Is this town? I was thinking I was out of town."
Captain Finch laughed at the jibe. He said,
"You must have traveled fast if you're here on that wagon of switch business." "That is the business, right enough."
"It was little Ned Pepper and 5 others. I suppose you know that."
"Yes. How much did they get?"
"Mr. Smallwood says they got $17,000 cash and a packet of registered mail from the safe. He has not got a total on the passenger claims. I'm afraid you're on a cold trail here.
When did you last see Ned?"
"I'm told he passed through here 2 days ago, he and Hayes and a Mexican on a round-bellied calico pony. I didn't see them myself. They won't be coming back this way." Rooster said,
"That Mexican was Grazer Bob."
"Is that the young one?"
"No, it's the old one, the original Bob from Fort Worth."
"I heard he was badly shot in Denison and had given up his reckless ways."
"Bob is hard to kill. He won't stay shot. I'm looking for another man. I think he is with Ned. He is short and has a black mark on his face, and he carries a Henry rifle."
Captain Finch thought about it. He said, "No. The way I got it, there was only the 3 here, Hayes and the Mexican and Ned.
We are watching his woman's house. It is a waste of time and none of my business, but I have sent a man out there."
Rooster said,
"It is a waste of time, all right. I know about where Ned is."
"Yes, I know too, but it will take 100 marshals to smoke him out of there."
"It won't take that many."
"It wouldn't take that many Choctaws. How many were in that marshal's party in August? 40?
It was closer to 50, said Rooster. Joe Schmidt was running that game, or misrunning it. I am running this one.
I'm surprised the Chief Marshal would turn you loose on a hunt like this with that supervision.
He can't help himself this time,
Captain Finch said. I could take you in there, Rooster, and show you how to bring Ned out.
Could you now? Well, an Indian makes too much noise to suit me. Don't you find it so, Gaspagoo?
That was the barber's name. He laughed and put his hand over his mouth. Gaspagoo is also the name of a fish that makes fair eating. I said to the captain, Perhaps you are wondering who I am. Yes, I was wondering that, said he. I thought you were a walking hat. My name is Matty Ross, said I. The man with the black mark goes by the name of Tom Cheney. He shot my father to death in Fort Smith and robbed him. Cheney was drunk, and my father was not armed at the time. That is a shame, said the captain. When we find him, we are going to club him with sticks and put him under arrest and take him back to Fort Smith, said I. I wish you luck. We don't want him down here. Rooster said,
Boots, I need a little help. I have got Hayes and some youngster out there, along with Emmett Quincy and Moon Garrett. I am after being in a hurry, and I wanted to see if you would not bury them boys for me.
They are dead?
All dead, said Rooster. What is it the judge says? Their depredations is now come to a fitting end.
Captain Finch pulled the barber's cloth from his neck. He and the barber went with us back to where the horses were tied. Rooster told them about our scrap at the dugout. The captain grasped each dead man by the hair of the head, and when he recognized a face, he grunted and spoke the name. The man Hayes had no hair to speak of, and Captain Finch lifted his head by the ears. We learned that the boy was called Billy. His father ran a steam sawmill on the South Canadian River, the captain told us, and there was a large family at home. Billy was one of the eldest children, and he had helped his father cut timber. The boy was not known to have been in any devilment before this. As for the other three, the captain did not know if they had any people who would want to claim the bodies. Rooster said,
All right, you hold Billy for the family and bury these others. I will post their names in Fort Smith, and if anybody wants them, they can come dig them up.
Then he went along behind the horses, slapping their rumps. He said,
These four horses was taken from Mr. Burlingame. These three right here belong to Hayes and Quincy and Moon. You get what you can for them, Boots, and sell the saddles and guns and coats, and I will split it with you. Is that fair enough?
I said, You told Moon you would send his brother the money owing to him from his traps. Rooster said,
I forgot where he said to send it.
I said, It is the district superintendent of the Methodist Church in Austin, Texas. His brother is a preacher named George Garrett.
Was it Austin or Dallas?
Austin.
Let's get it straight.
It was Austin.
All right, then. Write it down for the captain. Send this man $10, Boots, and tell him his brother got cut and is buried here.
Captain Finch said, Are you going out by way of Mr. Burlingame's?
I don't have the time, said Rooster. I'd like for you to send word out, if you will, just so Mr. Burlingame knows it was Deputy Marshal Rooster Cogburn that recovered them horses.
Do you want this girl with the hat to write it down?
I believe you can remember it if you try.
Captain Finch called out to some Indian youths who were standing nearby looking at us. I gathered he was telling them in the Choctaw tongue to see to the horses and the burial of the bodies. He had to speak to them a second time, and very sharply, before they would approach the bodies. The railroad agent was an older man named Smallwood. He praised us for our pluck, and he was very much pleased to see the sacks of cash and valuables we had recovered. You may think Rooster was hard in appropriating the traps of the dead men, but I will tell you that he did not touch 1 cent of the money that was stolen at gunpoint from the passengers of the Katy Flyer. Smallwood looked over the booty and said it would certainly help to cover the loss, though it was his experience that some of the victims would make exaggerated claims. He had known the martyred clerk personally, and he said the man had been a loyal employee of the MK&T for some years. In his youth, the clerk had been a well-known foot racer in Kansas. He showed his spunk right to the end. Smallwood did not know the fireman personally. In both cases, said he, the MK&T would try to do something for the bereaved families, though times were hard and revenue down. They say Jay Gould had no heart. Smallwood also assured Rooster that the railroad would do right by him, providing he clean up Lucky Ned Pepper's robber band and recover the stolen express funds. I advised Rooster to get a written statement from Smallwood to that effect, along with an itemized, timed, and dated receipt for the 2 sacks of booty. Smallwood was wary about committing his company too far, but we got a receipt out of him and a statement saying that Rooster had produced on that day the lifeless bodies of 2 men whom he alleges took part in said robbery. I think Smallwood was a gentleman, but gentlemen are only human, and their memories can sometimes fail them. Business is business. Mr. McAllister, who kept the store, was a good Arkansas man. He, too, commended us for our actions, and he gave us towels and pans of hot water and some sweet-smelling olive soap. His wife served us a good country dinner with fresh buttermilk. LeBeef joined us for the hearty meal. The medical-trained Indian had been able to remove all the big splinters and lead fragments, and he had bound the arm tightly. Naturally, the limb remained stiff and sore, yet the Texan enjoyed a limited use of it. When we had eaten our fill, Mr. McAllister's wife asked me if I did not wish to lie down on her bed for a nap. I was sorely tempted, but I saw through the scheme. I had noticed Rooster talking to her on the sly at the table. I concluded he was trying to get shed of me once again. "Thank you, ma'am. I am not tired," said I. It was the biggest story I have ever told. We did not leave right away because Rooster found that his horse Beau had dropped a front shoe. We went to a little shed kept by a blacksmith. While waiting there, LeBeef repaired the broken stock of his Sharps rifle by wrapping copper wire around it. Rooster hurried the smith along with the shoeing, as he was not disposed to linger in the settlement. He wished to stay ahead of the posse of marshals that he knew was even then scouring the brush for Lucky Ned Pepper and his band. He said to me,
"Sis, the time has come when I must move fast. It's a hard day's ride to where I'm going. You'll wait here, and Mrs. McAllister will see to your comfort. I'll be back tomorrow or the next day with our man."
"No, I am going along," said I. LeBeef said, "She has come this far."
Rooster said, "It is far enough."
I said, "Do you think I am ready to quit when we are so close?" LeBeef said, "There's something in what she says, Cogburn. I think she has done fine myself. She has won her spurs, so to speak. That is just my personal opinion." Rooster held up his hand and said,
"All right, let it go. I've said my piece. We won't have a lot of talk about winning spurs."
We departed the place around noon, traveling east and slightly south. Rooster called the turn when he said hard riding. That big, long-legged Beau just walked away from the 2 ponies, but the weight began to tell on him after a few miles, and little Blackie and the shaggy pony closed the distance on him ere long. We rode like the very Dickens for about 40 minutes, and then stopped and dismounted and walked for a spell, giving the horses a rest. It was while we were walking that a rider came up hallooing and overtook us. We were out on a prairie, and we saw him coming for some little distance. It was Captain Finch, and he brought exciting news. He told us that shortly after we had left McAllister's, he received word that Otis Wharton had broken from the basement jail in Fort Smith. The escape had taken place early that morning. Here is what happened. Not long after breakfast, two trusty prisoners brought in a barrel of clean sawdust for use in the spittoons of that foul dungeon. It was fairly dark down there, and in a moment when the guards were not looking, the trustees concealed Wharton and another doomed murderer inside the barrel. Both men were of slight stature and inconsiderable weight. The trustees then carried the two outside and away to freedom. A bold daylight escape in a fat barrel. Some clever stunt. The trustees ran off along with the convicted killers, and very likely drew good wages for their audacity. On hearing the news, Rooster did not appear angry or in any way perturbed, but only amused. You may wonder why. He had his reasons, and among them were these: that Wharton now stood no chance of winning a commutation from President R.B. Hayes, and also that the escape would cause Lawyer Gowdy a certain amount of chagrin in Washington City and would no doubt result in a big expense loss for him, as clients who resolve their own problems are apt to be slow in paying due bills from a lawyer. Captain Finch said, "I thought you had better know about this." Rooster said,
"I appreciate it, Boots. I appreciate you riding out here."
"Wharton will be looking for you."
"If he's not careful, he'll find me."
Captain Finch looked LaBeef over, then said to Rooster, "Is this the man who shot Ned's horse from under him?"
Rooster said,
"Yes, this is the famous horse killer from El Paso, Texas. His idea is to put everybody on foot. He says it will limit their mischief."
LaBeef's fair-complected face became congested with angry blood. He said,
"There was very little light, and I was firing offhand. I did not have the time to find a rest."
Captain Finch said,
"There is no need to apologize for that shot. A good many more people have missed Ned than have hit him."
"I was not apologizing," said LaBeef. "I was only explaining the circumstances."
"Rooster here has missed Ned a few times himself, horse and all," said the captain. "I reckon he is on his way now to missing him again."
Rooster was holding a bottle with a little whiskey in it. He said,
"You keep on thinking that."
He drained off the whiskey in about 3 swallows and tapped the cork back in and tossed the bottle up in the air. He pulled his revolver and fired at it twice and missed. The bottle fell and rolled, and Rooster shot at it 2 or 3 more times and broke it on the ground. He got out his sack of cartridges and reloaded the pistol. He said,
"The Chinaman is running them cheap shells in on me again."
LaBeef said,
"I thought maybe the sun was in your eyes. That is to say, your eye."
Rooster swung the cylinder back in his revolver and said,
"Eyes, is it? I'll show you eyes."
He jerked the sack of corn dodgers free from his saddle baggage. He got one of the dodgers out and flung it in the air and fired at it and missed. Then he flung another one up and he hit it. The corn dodger exploded. He was pleased with himself, and he got a fresh bottle of whiskey from his baggage and treated himself to a drink. LaBeef pulled one of his revolvers and got 2 dodgers out of the sack and tossed them both up. He fired very rapidly, but he only hit one. Captain Finch tried it with 2 and missed both of them. Then he tried with 1 and made a successful shot. Rooster shot at 2 and hit 1. They drank whiskey and used up about 60 corn dodgers like that. None of them ever hit 2 at 1 throw with a revolver, but Captain Finch finally did it with his Winchester repeating rifle, with somebody else throwing. It was entertaining for a while, but there was nothing educational about it. I grew more and more impatient with them. I said, "Come on, I have had my bait of this. I am ready to go. Shooting cornbread out here on this prairie is not taking us anywhere." By then, Rooster was using his rifle and the captain was throwing for him.
"Chunk high, not so far out this time," said he.
At length, Captain Finch took his leave and went back the way he came. We continued our journey eastward, with the Winding Stair Mountains as our destination. We lost a good half hour with that shooting foolishness, But worse than that, it started Rooster to drinking. He drank even as he rode, which looked difficult. I cannot say it slowed him down any, but it did make him silly. Why do people wish to be silly? We kept up our fast pace, riding hard for 40 or 50 minutes, and then going on foot for a piece. I believe those walks were a more welcome rest for me than for the horses. I have never claimed to be a cowboy. Little Blackie did not falter. He had good wind, and his spirit was such that he would not let LaBeef's shaggy mount get ahead of him on an open run. Yes, you bet he was a game pony. We loped across open prairies and climbed wooded limestone hills and made our way through brushy bottoms and icy streams. Much of the snow melted under the sun, but as the long shadows of dusk descended in all their purple loveliness, the temperature did likewise. We were very warm from our exertions, and the chill night air felt good at first, but then it became uncomfortable as we slowed our pace. We did not ride fast after dark, as it would have been dangerous for the horses. LaBeef said the rangers often rode at night to avoid the terrible Texas sun, and this was like nothing at all to him. I did not care for it myself. Nor did I enjoy the slipping and sliding when we were climbing the steep grades of the winding stair mountains. There is a lot of thick pine timber in those hills, and we wandered up and down in the double darkness of the forest. Rooster stopped us twice while he dismounted and looked around for sign. He was well along to being drunk. Later on, he got to talking to himself, and one thing I heard him say was this.
Well, we done the best we could with what we had. We was in a war. All we had was revolvers and horses.
I supposed he was brooding about the hard words LaBeef had spoken to him on the subject of his war service. He got louder and louder, but it was hard to tell whether he was still talking to himself or addressing himself to us. I think it was a little of both. On one long climb, he fell off his horse, but he quickly gained his feet and mounted again.
That was nothing, nothing, said he. Bo put a foot wrong, that was all. He's tired. This is no grade. I have freighted iron stoves up harder grades than this, and pork as well. I lost 14 barrels of pork on a shelf road not much steeper than this. An old cook never batted an eye. I was a pretty fair jerkline teamster, could always talk to mules, but oxen was something else. You don't get that quick play with cattle that you get with mules. They're slow to start, and slow to turn, and slow to stop. It taken me a while to learn it. Pork brought a thundering great price out there then, but old Cook was a square dealer, and he let me work it out at his lot price. Yes, sir, he paid liberal wages, too. He made money, and he didn't mind his help making money. I will tell you how much he made. He made $50,000 in 1 year with them wagons, but he did not enjoy good health, always down with something. He was all bowed over and his neck was stiff from drinking Jamaica ginger. He had to look up at you through his hair, like this, unless he was laying down. And, as I say, that rich jaybird was down a lot. He had a good head of brown hair, had every lock until he died. Of course, he was a right young man when he died. He only looked old. He was carrying a 21-foot tapeworm along with his business responsibilities, and that aged him, killed him in the end. I didn't even know he had it till he was dead, though he ate like a field hand, ate 5 or 6 good dinners every day. If he was alive today, I believe I would still be out there. Yes, I know I would, and I would likely have money in the bank. I had to make tracks when his wife commenced to run in things. She said, You can't leave me like this, Rooster. All my drivers is leaving me. I told her, I said, you watch me. No, sir. I was not ready to work for her, and I told her so. There is no generosity in women. They want everything coming in and nothing going out. They show no trust. Lord God, how they hate to pay you. They will get the work of two men out of you, and I guess they would beat you with whips if they was able to. No, sir, not me. Never. A man will not work for a woman, not unless he has clabber for brains.
LaBeef said, I told you that in Fort Smith. I did not know if the Texan intended the remark to tell against me, but if he did, it was water off a duck's back. You cannot give any weight to the words of a drunkard, and even so, I knew Rooster could not be talking about me in his drunken criticism of women, the kind of money I was paying him. I could have confounded him and his silliness right there by saying, "What about me? What about that $25 I have given you?" But I had not the strength nor the inclination to bandy words with a drunkard. What have you done when you have bested a fool? I thought we would never stop and must be nearing Montgomery, Alabama. From time to time, LaBeef and I would interrupt Rooster and ask him how much farther, and he would reply, "It's not far now." And then he would pick up again on a chapter in the long and adventurous account of his life. He had seen a good deal of strife in his travels. When at last we did stop, Rooster said only,
"I reckon this'll do."
It was well after midnight. We were on a more or less level place in a pine forest up in the hills, and that was all I could determine. I was so tired and stiff, I could not think straight. Rooster said he calculated we had come about 50 miles. 50 miles from McAllister's store, and were now positioned some 4 miles from Lucky Ned Pepper's bandit stronghold. Then he wrapped himself up in his buffalo robe and retired without ceremony, leaving LaBeef to see to the horses. The Texan watered them from the canteens and fed them and tied them out. He left the saddles on them for warmth, but with the girths loosened. Those poor horses were worn out. We made no fire. I took a hasty supper of bacon and biscuit sandwiches. The biscuits were pretty hard. There was a layer of pine straw under the patchy snow, and I raked up a thick pile with my hands for a woodland mattress. The straw was dirty and brittle and somewhat damp, but at that it made for a better bed than any I had seen on this journey. I rolled up in my blankets and slicker and burrowed down into the straw. It was a clear winter night, and I made out the Big Dipper and the North Star through the pine branches. The moon was already down. My back hurt, and my feet were swollen, and I was so exhausted that my hands quivered. The quivering passed, and I was soon in the land of Nod. Rooster was stirring about the next morning before the sun had cleared the higher mountains to the east. He seemed little worse for the wear, despite the hard riding and the drinking excesses and the short sleep. He did insist on having coffee, and he made a little fire of oak sticks to boil his water. The fire gave off hardly any smoke, white wisps that were quickly gone, but LaBeef called it a foolish indulgence, seeing we were so close to our quarry. I felt as though I had only just closed my eyes. The water in the canteens was low, and they would not let me have any for washing. I got the canvas bucket and put my revolver in it, and set off down the hill looking for a spring or a run-off stream. The slope was gentle at first, and then it fell off rather sharply. The brush grew thicker, and I checked my descent by grabbing bushes. Down and down I went. As I neared the bottom, dreading the return climb, I heard splashing and blowing noises. My thought was, what on earth? Then I came into the open on a creek bank. On the other side, there was a man watering some horses. The man was none other than Tom Chaney. You may readily imagine that I registered shock at the sight of that squat assassin. He had not yet seen me, nor heard me either because of the noise made by the horses. His rifle was slung across his back on the cotton plow line. I thought to turn and run, but I could not move. I stood there fixed. Then he saw me. He gave a start and brought the rifle quickly into play. He held the rifle on me and peered across the little stream and studied me. He said,
"Well now, I know you. Your name is Maddie. You are little Maddie the bookkeeper. Isn't this something?"
He grinned and took the rifle from play and slung it carelessly over his shoulder. I said, "Yes, and I know you, Tom Chaney." He said,
"What are you doing here?"
I said, "I came to fetch water."
"What are you doing here in these mountains?"
I reached into the bucket and brought out my Dragoon revolver. I dropped the bucket and held the revolver in both hands. I said, "I am here to take you back to Fort Smith." Chaney laughed and said,
"Well, I will not go. How do you like that?"
I said, "There is a posse of officers up on the hill who will force you to go."
"That is interesting news," said he. "How many is up there?"
"Right around 50. They are all well armed, and they mean business. What I want you to do now is leave those horses and come across the creek and walk in front of me up the hill."
He said, "I think I will oblige the officers to come after me."
He began to gather the horses together. There were 5 of them, but Papa's horse, Judy, was not among them. I said, "If you refuse to go, I will have to shoot you." He went on with his work and said,
"Oh, then you'd better cock your piece."
I had forgotten about that. I pulled the hammer back with both thumbs.
"All the way back till it locks," said Chaney.
"I know how to do it," said I. When it was ready, I said, "You will not go with me?"
"I think not," said he. "It is just the other way around. You are going with me."
I pointed the revolver at his belly and shot him down. The explosion kicked me backwards and caused me to lose my footing, and the pistol jumped from my hand. I lost no time in recovering it and getting to my feet. The ball had struck Chaney's side and knocked him into a sitting position against a tree. I heard Rooster or LaBeef call out for me. "I'm down here," I replied. There was another shout from the hill above Chaney. He was holding both hands down on his side. He said,
"I did not think you would do it."
I said, "What do you think now?" He said,
"One of my short ribs is broken. It hurts every breath I take."
I said, "You killed my father when he was trying to help you. I have one of the gold pieces you took from him. Now give me the other."
"I regret that shooting," said he. "Mr. Ross was decent to me, but he ought not to have meddled in my business. I was drinking, and I was mad through and through. Nothing has gone right for me."
There was more yelling from the hills. I said, "No, you are just a piece of trash, that is all. They say you shot a senator in the state of Texas."
"That man threatened my life. I was justified. Everything is against me. Now I am shot by a child."
"Get up on your feet and come across that creek before I shoot you again. My father took you in when you were hungry."
"You will have to help me up."
"No, I will not help you. Get up yourself." He made a quick move for a chunk of wood, and I pulled the trigger, and the hammer snapped on a bad percussion cap. I made haste to try another chamber, but the hammer snapped dead again. I had not time for a third try. Chaney flung the heavy piece of wood, and it caught me in the chest and laid me out backwards.
He came splashing across the creek, and he jerked me up by my coat and commenced slapping me and cursing me and my father. That was his cur nature, to change from a whining baby to a vicious bully as circumstances permitted. He stuck my revolver in his belt and pulled me stumbling through the water. The horses were milling about, and he managed to catch two of them by their halters while holding me with the other hand. I heard Rooster and LaBeef crashing down through the brush behind us and calling out for me. "Down here, hurry up," I shouted, and Chaney let go of my coat just long enough to give me another stinging slap. I must tell you that the slopes rose steeply on either side of the creek. Just as the two peace officers were running down on one side, so were Chaney's bandit friends running down the other, so that both parties were converging on the hollow and the little mountain stream. The bandits won the foot race. There were two of them, and one was a little man in woolly chaps, whom I rightly took to be Lucky Ned Pepper. He was still hatless. The other was taller and a quite well-dressed man in a linen suit and a bearskin coat, and his hat tied fast by a slipstring under his chin. This man was the Mexican gambler who called himself the Original Greaser Bob. They broke upon us suddenly and poured a terrible volley of fire across the creek with their Winchester repeating rifles. Lucky Ned Pepper said to Chaney, "Take them horses you got and move." Chaney did as he was told, and we started up with the horses. It was hard climbing. Lucky Ned Pepper and the Mexican remained behind and exchanged shots with Rooster and LaBeef while trying to catch the other horses. I heard running splashes as one of the officers reached the creek, then a flurry of shots as he was made to retreat. Chaney had to stop and catch his breath after 30 or 40 yards of pulling me and the two horses behind him. Blood showed through on his shirt. Lucky Ned Pepper and Greaser Bob overtook us there. They were pulling two horses. I supposed the fifth horse had run away or been killed. The leads of these two horses were turned over to Chaney, and Lucky Ned Pepper said to him, "Get up on that hill and don't be stopping again." The bandit chieftain took me roughly by the arm. He said, "Who all is down there?" "Marshal Cogburn and 50 more officers, said I. He shook me like a terrier shaking a rat. "Tell me another lie and I'll stove in your head." Part of his upper lip was missing, a sort of gap on one side that caused him to make a whistling noise as he spoke. 3 or 4 teeth were broken off there as well, yet he made himself clearly understood. Thinking it best, I said, "It is Marshal Cogburn and another man." He flung me to the ground and put a boot on my neck to hold me while he reloaded his rifle from a cartridge belt. He shouted out, "Rooster, can you hear me?" There was no reply. The Original Greaser was standing there with us, and he broke the silence by firing down the hill. Lucky Ned Pepper shouted, "You answer me, Rooster. I will kill this girl. You know I will do it." Rooster called up from below, "The girl is nothing to me. She is a runaway from Arkansas." "That's very well," said Lucky Ned Pepper. "Do you advise me to kill her?"
"Do what you think is best, Ned," replied Rooster. "She is nothing to me but a lost child. Think it over first."
"I have already thought it over. You and Potter get mounted double fast. If I see you riding over that bald ridge to the northwest, I will spare the girl. You have 5 minutes.
"We'll need more time."
"I will not give you any more."
"There will be a party of marshals in here soon, Ned. Let me have Chaney and the girl, and I will mislead them for 6 hours.
"Too thin, Rooster. Too thin. I won't trust you."
"I will cover you till dark."
"Your 5 minutes is running. No more talk."
Lucky Ned Pepper pulled me to my feet. Rooster called up again, saying,
"We are leaving, but you must give us time."
The bandit chieftain made no reply. He brushed the snow and dirt from my face and said,
"Your life depends upon their actions. I have never busted a cap on a woman or anybody much under 16 years, but I will do what I have to do."
I said, "There is some mix-up here.
I am Maddie Ross of near Dardanelle, Arkansas. My family has property, and I don't know why I am being treated like this. Lucky Ned Pepper said,
It is enough that you know I will do what I have to do.
We made our way up the hill. A little farther along, we came across a bandit armed with a shotgun and squatting behind a big slab of limestone. This man's name was Harold Parmalee. I believe he was simple-minded. He gobbled at me like a turkey until Lucky Ned Pepper made him hush. Greaser Bob was told to stay there with him behind the rock and keep a watch below. I had seen this Mexican gambler fall from Rooster's shots at the dugout, but he appeared now to be in perfect health, and there was no outward evidence of a wound. When we left them there, Harold Parmalee made a noise like, Woo-ha! And this time it was the greaser who made him hush. Lucky Ned Pepper pushed me along in front of him through the brush. There was no trail. His woolly chaps sang as they swished back and forth, something like corduroy trousers. He was little and wiry, and no doubt a hard customer, but still his wind was not good, and he was blowing like a man with asthma by the time we had ascended to the bandit's lair. They had made their camp on a bare rock shelf, some 70 yards or so below the crest of the mountain. Pine timber grew in abundance below and above and on all sides. No apparent trails led to the place. The ledge was mostly level, but broken here and there by deep pits and fissures. A shallow cave provided sleeping quarters, as I saw bedding and saddles strewn about inside. A wagon sheet, now pulled back, served for a door and windbreak. The horses were tied in the cover of trees. It was quite windy up there, and the little cooking fire in front of the cave was protected by a circle of rocks. The site overlooked a wide expanse of ground to the west and north. Tom Cheney was sitting by the fire with his shirt pulled up, and another man was ministering to him, tying a pad of cloth to his wounded side with a cotton rope. The man laughed as he cinched the rope up tight and caused Cheney to whimper with pain.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa," said the man, making sounds like a bawling calf in mockery of Cheney.
This man was Farrell Parmalee, a younger brother to Harold Parmalee. He wore a long blue army overcoat with officer's boards on the shoulders. Harold Parmalee had participated in the robbery of the Katy Flyer, and Farrell joined the bandits later that night when they swapped horses at Ma Parmalee's place. The Parmalee woman was a notorious receiver of stolen livestock, but was never brought to law. Her husband, Henry Joe Parmalee, killed himself with a dynamite cap in the ugly act of wrecking a passenger train. A family of criminal trash. Of her youngest boys, Carol Parmalee lived long enough to be put to death in the electric chair. And not long afterward, Darryl Parmalee was shot to death at the wheel of a motor car by a bank dick and a constable in Mena, Arkansas. No, do not compare them to Henry Starr or the Dalton brothers. Certainly Starr and the Daltons were robbers and reckless characters, but they were not simple, and they were not altogether rotten. You will remember that Bob and Grat Dalton served as marshals for Judge Parker, and Bob was a fine one, they say. Upright men gone bad. What makes them take the wrong road? Bill Doolin, too. A cowboy gone wrong. When Lucky Ned Pepper and I gained the rock ledge, Cheney jumped up and made for me.
I will wring your scrawny neck, he exclaimed.
Lucky Ned Pepper pushed him aside and said,
No, I won't have it. Let that doctoring go and get the horses saddled. Lend him a hand, Fal.
He pushed me down by the fire and said,
Sit there and be still.
When he had caught his breath, he took a spyglass from his coat and searched the rocky dome to the west. He saw nothing and took a seat by the fire and drank coffee from a can and ate some bacon from a skillet with his hands. There was plenty of meat and several cans of water in the fire, some with plain water and some with coffee already brewed. I concluded the bandits had been at their breakfast when they were alarmed by the gunshot down below. I said, "Can I have some of that bacon?" Lucky Ned Pepper said,
"Help yourself. Have some coffee."
"I don't drink coffee. Where is the bread?"
"We lost it." "Tell me what you're doing here."
I took a piece of bacon and chewed on it. "I will be glad to tell you," said I. "You will see I am in the right. Tom Cheney there shot my father to death in Fort Smith and robbed him of 2 gold pieces and stole his mare. Her name is Judy, but I do not see her here. I was informed Rooster Cogburn had grit, and I hired him out to find the murderer. A few minutes ago, I came upon Cheney down there watering horses. He would not be taken in charge, and I shot him. If I had killed him, I would not now be in this fix. My revolver misfired twice."
"He will do it," said Lucky Ned Pepper. "It'll embarrass you every time."
Then he laughed. He said,
"Most girls like play pretties, but you like guns, don't you?"
"I don't care a thing in the world about guns. If I did, I would have one that worked." Cheney was carrying a load of bedding from the cave. He said,
"I was shot from ambush, Ned. The horses was blowing and making noise. It was one of them officers that got me."
I said, "How can you stand there and tell such a big story?" Cheney picked up a stick and pitched it into a big crack in the ledge. He said,
"Here's a ball of rattlesnakes down there in that pit, and I'm going to throw you in it. How do you like that?"
"No, you won't," said I. "This man will not let you have your way. He is your boss, and you must do as he tells you."
Lucky Ned Pepper again took his glass and looked across at the ridge. Cheney said,
5 minutes is well up."
"I'll give him a little more time," said the bandit chieftain.
"How much more?"
said Cheney.
"Till I think they've had enough."
Greaser Bob called up from below, saying,
"They are gone, Ned. I can hear nothing. We had best make a move."
Lucky Ned Pepper replied,
"Hold fast for a while."
Then he returned to his breakfast. He said,
"Was that Rooster and Potter that waylaid us last night?"
I said, "The man's name is not Potter, it is LaBeef. He is an officer from Texas. He is looking for Cheney, too, though he calls him by another name."
"Is he the one with a buffalo gun?"
"He calls it a Sharp's rifle. His arm was hurt in the fight."
"He shot my horse. A man from Texas has no authority to fire at me."
"I know nothing about that. I have a good lawyer at home."
"Did they take Quincy and Moon?"
"They are both dead. It was a terrible thing to see. I was in the very middle of it. Do you need a good lawyer?"
"I need a good judge. What about Hayes, an old fella?"
"Yes, he and the young man were both killed."
"I saw Billy was dead when he was struck. I thought Hayes might have made it. He was as tough as boot leather. I am sorry for him."
"Are you not sorry for the boy Billy?"
"He should never have been there. There was nothing I could do for him."
"How did you know he was dead?"
"I could tell. I advised him against coming, and then give in to him against what I knowed was best."
"Where did you take him?"
"To McAllister's store."
"I will tell you what he did at Wagner's switch."
"My lawyer has political influence."
"This will amuse you. I posted him with the horses out of danger and told him to fire a string of shots with his rifle now and then. You must have shooting for the way it keeps the passengers in their seats. Well, he started out all right, and then as the job went along, I noticed the shots had stopped. I figured Billy Boy had run for home and a plate of mother's soup. Bob went to see about him, and he found a boy standing out there in the dark, shucking good shells out of his guns. He thought he was shooting, but he was so scared he could not remember to pull the trigger. That was how green he was, green as a July persimmon."
I said, You do not show much kindly feeling for a young man who saved your life.
I am happy he done it, said Lucky Ned Pepper. I don't say he want game. I say he was green. All kids is game, but a man will keep his head and look out for his own self. Look at old Hayes. Well, he's dead now, but he should have been dead 10 times afore now. Yes, and your good friend Rooster. That goes for him as well.
He is not my friend. Farrell Parmalee made a whooping noise like that of his brother, and said,
There they be.
I looked over to the northwest and saw 2 riders approaching the top of the ridge. Little Blackie, riderless, was tied behind them. Lucky Ned Pepper brought his glass into play, but I could see them well enough without such aid. When they reached the crest, they paused and turned our way, and Rooster fired a pistol in the air. I saw the smoke before the noise reached us. Lucky Ned Pepper pulled his revolver and fired an answering shot. Then Rooster and Labeef disappeared over the hill. The last thing I saw was Little Blackie. I think it did not come home to me until that moment what my situation was. I had not thought Rooster or Labeef would give in to the bandits so easily. It was in my mind that they would slip up through the brush and attack the bandits while they were disorganized, or employ some clever ruse known only by detectives to bring the bandits to heel. Now they were gone. The officers had left me. I was utterly cast down, and for the first time I feared for my life. My mind was filled with anxiety. Who was to blame? Deputy Marshal Rooster Cogburn. The gabbing, drunken fool had made a mistake of 4 miles and led us directly into the robber's lair. A keen detective. Yes, and in an earlier state of drunkenness, he had placed faulty caps in my revolver, causing it to fail me in a time of need. That was not enough. Now he had abandoned me in this howling wilderness to a gang of cutthroats who cared not a rap for the blood of their own companions, and how much less for that of a helpless and unwanted youngster. Was this what they called grit in Fort Smith? We called it something else in Yell County. Lucky Ned Pepper shouted out for the original greaser and Harold Parmalee to leave their watch post and come to the camp. The 4 horses were saddled and in readiness. Lucky Ned Pepper looked over the mounts, then at the spare saddle that lay on the ground. It was an old saddle, but a handsome one, decorated with fixtures of beaten silver. He said,
That is Bob's saddle.
Tom Cheney said,
It was Bob's horse we lost. That you lost, said the bandit chieftain. Unsaddle that gray and put Bob's saddle up.
I am riding the gray, said Cheney.
I have other plans for you.
Cheney set about unsaddling the gray horse. He said,
I will be riding behind Bob?
No, it will be too chancy with 2 men up if it comes to a race. When we reach Ma's house, I will send Carol back to fetch you with a fresh mount. I want you to wait here with the girl. You will be out by dark. We are going to the old place, and you can meet us there.
Well, I don't like that, said Cheney. Let me ride with you, Ned, just out of here anyway.
No.
Them marshals will be up here.
They will guess we are all gone.
I said, I am not staying here by myself with Tom Cheney. Lucky Ned Pepper said,
That is the way I will have it.
He will kill me, said I. You have heard him say it. He has killed my father, and now you will let him kill me.
He will do no such thing, said the bandit chieftain. Tom, do you know the crossing at Cypress Forks, near the log meeting house?
I know the place.
You will take the girl there and leave her.
Then, to me,
You can stay the night in the meeting house. There's a dummy called Flanagan, lives about 2 miles up the creek. He has a mule, and he will see you to McAllister's. He cannot speak or hear, but he can read. Can you write?
Yes, said I. Let me go now on foot.
I will find my way out.
No, I won't have it. Tom will not harm you. Do you understand that, Tom? If any harm comes to this child, you do not get paid.
Chaney said, Farrell, let me ride up with you.
Farrell Parmalee laughed and made noises like an owl, saying, Hoo, hoo, hoo. Harold Parmalee and the original greaser Bob came up, and Chaney commenced to plead with them to share their mount. Greaser Bob said no. The Parmalee brothers now teamed together like silly boys and would give Chaney no sensible answer. Harold Parmalee would interrupt Chaney's question each time with mockery, making animal sounds such as are made by pigs and goats and sheep, and Farrell would laugh at the sport and say,
Do it again, Harold. Do a goat.
Chaney said,
Everything is against me.
Lucky Ned Pepper made sure the buckles were fastened good on his saddle wallet.
Greaser Bob said, Ned, let us cut up the winnings now.
There will be time for that at the old place, replied the bandit chieftain.
We have been in two scraps already, said the greaser. We have lost two men. I would feel easier if I was carrying my own weanings.
Lucky Ned Pepper said,
Well, Bob, I thought your interest was in saving time.
You will not take long. I will feel easier.
Very well, then. It suits me. I want you to feel easy.
He reached inside one of the saddle wallets and pulled out four packets of greenbacks and pitched them to Greaser Bob.
How is that?
Greaser Bob said. You will not count it?
We won't quarrel over a dollar or two.
Then he gave one packet to Harold Parmalee and a single $50 note to Farrell Parmalee. The brothers said,
Hoo-ha! Hoo-ha!
I wondered that they did not press for more, in light of the total amount realized in the robbery, but I supposed they had agreed to a fixed wage for their services. I judged, too, that they were somewhat ignorant of the value of money. Lucky Ned Pepper went to buckle up the wallet again. He said,
I'll keep your winnings with mine, Tom. You'll be paid tonight at the old place.
Chaney said,
Nothing is going right for me.
Greaser Bob said,
What about the registered pouch?
Well, and what about it?
Said Lucky Ned Pepper.
Are you expecting a letter, Bob?
If there is any money in it, we may as well have it now. It makes no sense to carry the pouch about for evidence.
You still don't feel easy?
You are making too much of my words, Ned.
Lucky Ned Pepper thought about it. He said,
Well, maybe so.
Once more, he unbuckled the straps. He took out a locked canvas bag and cut it open with a Barlow knife and dumped the contents on the ground. He grinned and said,
Christmas gift?
Of course, that is what children shout to one another early on Christmas morning, the game being to shout it first. I had not thought before of this disfigured robber having had a childhood. I expect he was mean to cats and made rude noises in church when he was not asleep. When he needed a firm restraining hand, it was not there. An old story. There were only 6 or 7 pieces of mail in the bag. There were some personal letters, one with $20 in it, and some documents that appeared to be of a legal description, such as contracts. Lucky Ned Pepper glanced at them and flung them away. A bulky gray envelope tied with ribbon held a packet of $120 notes on the Whelper Commercial Bank of Denison, Texas. Another envelope held a check. Lucky Ned Pepper studied it, then said to me,
Do you read well?
I read very well, said I.
He passed over the check.
Is this any good to me?
It was a cashier's check for $2,750 drawn on the Granger's Trust Company of Topeka, Kansas, to a man named Marshall Purvis. I said, This is a cashier's check for $2,750 drawn on the Granger's Trust Company of Topeka, Kansas, to a man named Marshall Purvis.
I can see what it's worth, said the bandit. Is it any good?
It is good if the bank is good,